Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So we talked in a previous episode about the SIM card, the seemingly very anachronistic little piece of plastic. And I asked a simple question. Why in 2026 do we still have SIM cards? It's a tiny amount of data that they're holding. Given that you can buy a terabyte micro SD card that's about the same size as a SIM card, they could fit so much more. It just seems so superfluous. And we talked about how that's actually a very developed world mindset, that in large parts of the world, this basically, the world still works on SIMs, and it's very entrenched in terms of how people actually use phones and use access cell phone plans, that it's not that simple. People are very accustomed to buying a SIM card. And what I'd like to ask about today, Herman and Corin, is I never looked for eSIM. I never really looked into eSIMs because I don't have an eSIM phone. And I never bought one because where I live in Israel until fairly recently, eSIMs weren't really a thing here. And I just got used to having my two SIM cards, one for business, one for my personal phone, and it serves me pretty well. But it's illogical, and it's not actually too hard to think about ways in which two SIM cards isn't enough. I mentioned if I'm traveling in the US that I have to, or if I wanted to pick up a data plan, I have to, you know, take out one SIM card, put in a data plan. So I did a bit of Googling and I saw, hey, there's a potential solution. Someone's come up with a physical SIM to eSIM gizmo, and basically lets you pop in a SIM card to which you can load eSIM profiles on. You have to check if your device is compatible. So decent stopgap solution. And it got me wondering, most of the things they were selling on this website, the eSIM physical converter was kind of an afterthought, because I guess most people who are really interested in eSIM probably have an eSIM capable phone and don't have a need for this thing. But the diversity of eSIM global plans was surprising to me. It's a very competitive space and it's a very noisy consumer vertical, with everyone saying we are the ultimate solution. Now, why I'm wondering, Herman and Corin, is if we think about roaming for those who travel frequently. Roaming was traditionally very expensive. And even now, if I don't have roaming in my plan, and I hate having to buy a plan just for the 1 or 2 weeks I might be traveling internationally, I'm really not on the road that much these days, that you have to look for one that gives you a certain amount of minutes when you're abroad. I always assumed that it was just kind of a bit of a scam, because does it really cost a mobile network operator anything else, any more for a visitor than it does for a local? So it seemed like just a markup to me, and it really kind of goes against this concept of global connectivity that we have to worry about these things. So what interests me about the concept of eSIM would be this idea of having one eSIM profile that kind of works around the world. Now, I know that to work around the world, we need not just an eSIM, we need also a compatible phone. But there's been a lot of progress in recent years in terms of, I'm not too young to remember the day when it wasn't a given that a phone would work in the US. You had to check frequencies. And for many years now, traveling between mostly the US, Ireland, and Israel, I've checked every new handset as a matter of course, but basically it's all worked. So we're in an era where, you know, phones work internationally for the most part, or in good chunks of the world. And I'm wondering if there are really eSIM providers that can offer something like a global SIM card that you can use it locally, internationally, not be nickel and dimed, so to speak, on local carriers. And it's all delivered at a monthly fee that your average person can afford. Tangentially, I was looking recently at these IoT SIM cards, which is another interesting area, SIM cards intended for IoT devices. And some of these similarly offer the promise of global coverage. So Herman and Korn, the marketing, as mentioned, is noisy. Do these global eSIMs truly exist? And if they do, does that mean we're going to see the end of buying our cell phone subscriptions from the mobile network operator? Or can we conceive of an era fast approaching in which the MNO just operates the infrastructure in a country and bills the eSIM providers who supply the end connectivity? And we're going to see the end, if that were the case, of the physical infrastructure of broadcasting a cellular network and selling it direct to consumer, that model coming to an end. Because it would probably be, I would say, good for consumers. And we wouldn't have to think any more about issues like roaming, etc. How close do you think that era is, Herman and Korn? And can we already pick up a global eSIM that will pretty much do exactly what I'm describing?
You know, Herman, I was looking at my phone the other day. It is a February morning in 2026, and I realized I haven't actually touched a physical SIM card in almost 3 years. I remember the days of hunting for a paperclip or a specialized little metal tool just to swap networks. It feels like one of those technologies that just evaporated when we weren't looking, like physical car keys or wired headphones.
Herman Poppleberry at your service, and you are right, Korn. The physical SIM card is effectively a museum piece for most flagship smartphone users today. It is a classic case of a legacy technology being phased out by sheer convenience and the relentless pursuit of internal device space. Every square millimeter inside a chassis is prime real estate for battery or haptics. But our housemate Daniel sent us a prompt today that really digs into the next layer of that transition. He is looking at the explosion of the eSIM market, especially for international roaming, and asking if we are heading toward a world where the big mobile network operators, the ones with the towers and the multi-billion dollar logos, are just the background infrastructure while we all buy our service from these global eSIM aggregators.
It is a great question, and honestly, a timely one. Daniel was mentioning how his social media feeds are just plastered with ads for truly global eSIMs that promise local rates everywhere from Albania to Zambia. It makes you wonder, if I can just download a profile that works in London, New York, and Jerusalem for a flat monthly fee, why would I ever walk into a carrier store and sign a 2-year contract again? Why deal with the credit checks and the free tablet that actually costs $20 a month for service?
You've hit on the key point. And to answer Daniel's first question, do truly global eSIMs exist that work both locally and internationally for a reasonable fee? The answer is a very nuanced yes, but with some major technical and economic caveats that most people do not realize. We have definitely moved past the era where you had to pay $10 a megabyte for roaming, thank goodness, but the dream of a single, cheap, global subscription is still fighting against some pretty stiff reality.
Well, let's start there. Because when I look at apps like Aerolo or Holofly or Nomad, or even the newer ones like Better Roaming that have gained traction in the last year, they all claim to have these global plans. But when you actually dig into the fine print, the global ones are often significantly more expensive than the country-specific ones. If I buy a plan for just Italy, it is dirt cheap. If I buy the global plan that includes Italy, the price triples. Why is that? If it is all just digital bits and software-defined networking, why does the geography still matter so much in 2026?
It comes down to what is called the interconnect agreement. Even now, the cellular world is basically a massive, messy web of bilateral contracts. When an eSIM provider like Aerolo sells you a global plan, they are not actually a carrier. They do not own a single cell tower. They are what we call an aggregator, or a high-level mobile virtual network operator, or MVNO. They have gone out and negotiated wholesale rates with hundreds of different carriers around the world.
So they are basically a travel agent for data.
That's a perfect analogy. And just like a travel agent, they have to pay a wholesale price to the airline, or in this case, the network operator. Some countries have very cheap wholesale rates because their domestic markets are hyper-competitive. Think of India, Italy, or parts of Southeast Asia. Others, like the United States, Canada, or Switzerland, are notoriously expensive for wholesalers to access. When an eSIM provider creates a global plan, they have to average out those costs.
They cannot easily charge you one price in Rome and a different price when you take the train to Zurich without making the user experience confusing. So, you end up paying a premium so that the provider does not lose money when you happen to be in a high-cost country. They are essentially selling you an insurance policy against high roaming rates.
That makes sense from a business perspective, but there is a technical side to this that I think we should talk about, because I have noticed that when I use a roaming eSIM, the latency is sometimes terrible. I will be in Tokyo, trying to load a map, and it takes 5 seconds to even start the request. My phone thinks I am in a different country entirely. I have had websites serve me ads in Polish while I am standing in the middle of Shinjuku. Why does that happen?
Oh, I am so glad you noticed that, Korn. That is the secret frustration of the current eSIM era. It is called home routing. Most of these global eSIM providers route all your data back through a central server or a gateway in a specific country. This is often because the roaming agreement requires the data to be authenticated by the home network. So, let us say you buy a global eSIM from a company that uses a core network based in Warsaw or Hong Kong. Even if you are standing in the middle of Paris, every time you load a website, your data travels from your phone in Paris, all the way to that server in Poland, out to the open internet, back to Poland, and then finally back to your phone in Paris.
That is wild. No wonder the ping times are like 500 or 600 milliseconds. It is literally circling the globe just to check my email or see if the cafe is open.
That's right. It is what we call tromboning. The data path looks like a giant trombone slide. And that is the primary difference between a travel eSIM and a true local subscription. A local provider uses what is called local breakout, where your data hits the local internet exchange immediately. Now, in 2026, some of the high-end global eSIM providers are starting to implement regional gateways. They might have one in Singapore, one in Amsterdam, and one in Virginia to fix this. But it is expensive to maintain that infrastructure. So when Daniel asks if these global eSIMs are the ultimate solution, the answer is they are getting there. But for things like cloud gaming, professional video calls, or anything where latency matters, that home routing lag can still be a total deal breaker.
So, let us look at the second part of Daniel's question. Does this signal the end of buying subscriptions directly from the mobile network operators? I mean, if I am a consumer, I do not care about interconnect agreements or home routing. I just want my phone to work. If these third-party apps provide a better user experience, if I can buy data in 3 taps instead of talking to a salesperson, why would anyone stick with the big guys?
This is where the power dynamic gets really interesting. The big mobile network operators, the MNOs, are in a bit of a bind. On one hand, they love the wholesale revenue. Selling massive blocks of data to an eSIM aggregator is easy money with zero customer service overhead. They do not have to worry about your billing disputes or your broken screen. Arelo or Nomad handles that. But on the other hand, they are terrified of becoming what the industry calls a dumb pipe.
Right, because if they are just the infrastructure, they lose the relationship with the customer. They cannot upsell you on a family plan, or a Netflix bundle, or a new phone upgrade every 12 months.
Precisely. They become like the water company or the power grid. Nobody cares who their power provider is as long as the lights stay on and the price is fair. But the MNOs have spent decades and billions of dollars building brands like Verizon, Vodafone, or T-Mobile. They want you to feel a sense of loyalty to the Magenta or the Red. What we are seeing now is a bifurcation of the market. The big carriers are trying to launch their own digital-only sub-brands to compete with the eSIM startups. They are trying to offer the same 3-tap experience, but keeping you on their own core network to avoid that latency we talked about.
I have seen that. It is like they are trying to disrupt themselves before someone else does it for them. But isn't there a regulatory hurdle here too? I remember we talked about this briefly in an earlier episode, maybe around episode 400 or so, about how different countries have very different laws about who can actually buy a phone number.
You have a great memory, Korn. Yes, the Know Your Customer laws, or KYC, are a huge barrier to a truly frictionless global eSIM. In many countries, think of Germany, Turkey, or Thailand, you are legally required to provide a passport or a local identification to activate a cellular line. This is meant to prevent crime and anonymous burner phones, but it makes the one-click global eSIM dream very difficult.
So how do the eSIM apps get around that? I have bought eSIMs for dozens of countries, and I rarely have to upload my passport.
Most of them only provide data. That is the loophole. If you do not have a traditional phone number attached to the SIM-1, they can send and receive short message service or make public switched telephone network voice calls. The regulations in many jurisdictions are much more relaxed. That is why most travel eSIMs are data only. You use WhatsApp, Signal, or FaceTime for your calls, and you just use the eSIM for the data pipe. But Daniel's prompt is about a total replacement of the MNO subscription. If you want a real, local phone number that can receive short message service codes from your bank or your government services, you usually still have to deal with a local carrier and their identity verification process.
That feels like a significant missing piece. If I cannot get my bank's two-factor authentication codes on my global eSIM, it is not a full replacement yet. I am still tethered to my home, number just for the sake of identity. But let's look at the infrastructure side. Daniel asked if we are approaching an era where MNOs simply provide the infrastructure for eSIM providers. How close are we to that actually being the dominant reality?
We are closer than the big carriers would like to admit. In the industry, we call this the wholesale-led model. Think about how the internet works. You might pay a local company for your fiber connection, but they are often just leasing lines from a much larger backbone provider like Lumen or Zayo. We are seeing the same thing happen with cellular towers. In many parts of the world, the companies that own the towers are actually separate from the companies that provide the cellular service.
Wait, really? So the logo on the tower might not even be the company I pay my bill to?
Frequently, yes. There are these massive companies called tower cos like American Tower or Cellnex that just build and maintain the physical steel, the power supply, and the cooling. Then they lease space on that tower to 3 or 4 different carriers. So the MNOs are already moving toward an asset-light model. The next logical step, which is what Daniel is pointing toward, is that the MNOs stop caring about the retail customer entirely. They just focus on the radio access network and the spectrum. They become wholesale operators.
But that sounds like a race to the bottom for them, doesn't it? If they are just selling bulk data to aggregators, their margins are going to get squeezed until there is nothing left.
That is the big fear. But here is the counter-argument. It is much more efficient. If a carrier does not have to spend billions on marketing, Super Bowl ads, retail stores, and massive call centers, they can be much more profitable even at lower margins per gigabyte. We are seeing this shift in the automotive industry too. Some car manufacturers are now acting as the eSIM provider for their vehicles. When you buy a modern car in 2026, it comes with a global data plan built in for the navigation and the entertainment system. The car company is the one negotiating with the carriers behind the scenes. You never even know which network you are on. Your car might be using AT&T in the suburbs and switching to a local rural provider in the mountains, and it is all invisible to you.
That is a great point. It is becoming invisible. And if it is invisible, the brand of the carrier doesn't matter. But what about the technology itself? I have been reading about something called iSIM with an I. Is that different from the eSIMs we are using now?
Oh, iSIM is the next evolution, and it is going to accelerate everything Daniel is asking about. So, an eSIM is still a physical chip. It is just a tiny, tiny chip soldered onto the motherboard of your phone. An iSIM, or integrated SIM, actually moves the SIM functionality directly into the main processor of the device, the system on a chip. It takes up virtually zero space and uses almost no power.
So it is not even a separate chip anymore. It is just a few lines of code inside the central processing unit.
Essentially, yes. It is a secure enclave within the processor. This is huge because it means every single connected device, from your toothbrush to your glasses to your smartwatch, can have cellular connectivity without adding any bulk or cost. When you have billions of iSIM devices, the idea of managing individual carrier subscriptions for each one becomes absurd. You cannot go to a Verizon store to get a plan for your smart toaster. You need a centralized, global platform to manage all those connections.
So in that world, the aggregators that Daniel is talking about become the essential layer. They are the ones who can manage 10 billion devices across 500 different networks with one application programming interface.
That's right. And the MNOs will have to decide if they want to be the ones running those platforms or if they are content just being the ones who own the spectrum and the hardware. It is a classic platform versus utility battle.
It reminds me a bit of what happened with the airlines. You had the companies that own the planes and do the flying, the Deltas and the Lufthansas. But most people book through Expedia, Kayak, or Google Flights. The airlines hate it because they lose the direct connection and the ability to sell you a credit card. But for the consumer, the aggregation is just too convenient to ignore.
That is a perfect comparison. And just like the airlines, the carriers are trying to fight back by offering loyalty points and bundled services. But at the end of the day, if I am traveling or if I just want a simple, transparent monthly bill, the aggregator is going to win. And there is one more thing that is going to blow this wide open by the end of this year, satellite-to-cell technology.
Oh, right. We have been hearing about this for a while. Like what Starlink and some of the other companies are doing with direct-to-cell service. Is that actually ready for prime time?
It is getting there. In 2024 and 2025, it was mostly for emergency short message service and basic texting. But here, in early 2026, we are seeing the first commercial data plans that allow for basic web browsing and email directly via satellite on a standard smartphone. No special antenna required.
That is a massive shift. So, instead of a patchwork of 500 carriers, you might have 3 or 4 global satellite networks that provide the base layer of connectivity everywhere on Earth.
And that is the ultimate global eSIM. A satellite provider doesn't care about national borders. They do not have to negotiate with a local carrier in the middle of the Sahara Desert. They air the network. The satellite providers are going to be the ultimate global eSIM players. Now, they won't replace 5G or 6G in cities. The bandwidth just isn't there yet, but they provide a global floor. You will have a base level of connectivity everywhere, and your phone will automatically switch to a local high-speed tower when one is available. The handoff between those layers will be handled by the eSIM or iSIM profile.
It sounds like we are moving toward a world of seamless connectivity, where the consumer doesn't even have to think about it. But I wonder about the downside. If we move away from local carriers, do we lose that local accountability? If my service goes out in Jerusalem or London, I can go down to the store and complain to a human. If my global eSIM provider is a startup in San Francisco or a satellite company in orbit, who do I talk to when my data stops working?
That is the classic trade-off of the digital era, isn't it? We trade local accountability for global convenience. We have seen this with almost every other industry. But I think there is another risk, which is the risk of a single point of failure. If one of these major global aggregators has a technical glitch or a security breach, they could potentially knock out connectivity for millions of people across dozens of countries simultaneously. We saw a version of this with the big cloud outages a few years back. If the authentication server for a global eSIM goes down, it doesn't matter how many towers are near you, your phone won't be allowed on the network.
That is a scary thought. We have seen how fragile the internet backbone can be. If the cellular layer becomes just as centralized, a single mistake could be catastrophic. But to Daniel's question about how close we are to this becoming a reality, I would say we are in the middle of the transition right now. In 2026, we are seeing the first generation of truly competitive global eSIM plans that are actually usable as a primary subscription. They are not perfect yet. The latency and the know-your-customer issues are still there, but the momentum is clearly moving away from the traditional carrier model.
I agree. If you look at the numbers, the travel eSIM market has grown by over 400% in the last 3 years. People are getting used to the idea that their home carrier is just one of many options.
So, if you were Daniel, would you ditch your local carrier right now and go for one of these global solutions?
It depends on your lifestyle. If you are a digital nomad or someone who travels across borders once a month, like many people do in Europe or even here in the Middle East, it is starting to make a lot of sense. You can get a global plan for around $50 or $60 a month now that gives you a decent bucket of data in 100 countries. But if you mostly stay in one place, the local carriers still have the home court advantage. They can offer better latency, better local support, and usually better pricing for high volume data. If you are a heavy user who watches 4K video on the bus, a local 5G plan is still going to beat a global eSIM every time. But that gap is closing every single year.
It is fascinating to think about. It is almost like the phone number itself is becoming an anachronism. If we are all using database messaging and global eSIMs, the idea of a 10-digit number tied to a specific geographic region feels like a relic of the 20th century. Why do I have a New York area code when I haven't lived there in a decade?
It really is. We are moving toward a global identity model rather than a local phone number model. Your connectivity will be tied to you, to your biometric identification, or your secure enclave, not to your physical location. And that is exactly what Daniel was sensing. The mobile network operators are becoming the pipes, and we are the ones who will decide which platform we want to use to manage those pipes.
Well, this has been an incredible deep dive. I feel like I understand the chips in my phone a lot better now, even if I never actually see them. And before we wrap up, I just want to say, if you are listening and you are finding these deep dives helpful, we would really appreciate it if you could leave a review on your podcast app. It genuinely helps other people discover the show and keeps us going.
It really does. We love hearing from you and seeing the show grow. And if you have a weird prompt of your own, something that has been on your mind while you were staring at your phone or traveling, head over to myweirdprompts.com and send it our way through the contact form. We read every single one.
Thanks again to Daniel for this prompt. It was a great follow-up to our previous discussion about the death of the physical SIM. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and at myweirdprompts.com, where we have our full archive of over 500 episodes.
This has been My Weird Props. I am Herman Poppleberry.
And I am Korn. Thanks for listening, everyone. We will see you in the next one.
Goodbye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.